Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Tuesday, July 30th, 2024. Residents across South Sudan mark Martyrs' Day.
We have fought for a just cause. We have achieved independence of our country, a dream of so many generations before us. And so this alone is a source of inspiration for the future generations.
And Deputy Police Spokesperson in South Sudan says the heavy deployment of security forces on the streets of the capital is for precautions.
Not showing the force to frighten them or to cause uproar, but to tell them that we are ready to protect them, their life and their property.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Residents of South Sudan's capital, Juba, say they are living in a police state following heavy deployment of security forces on the streets of the capital. But South Sudan's deputy police spokesperson says there is no reason for residents of Juba town to panic. Brigadier General James Carlos Duck says the deployment is for, quote, precautionary measures.
You people want to voice their grievance. Let them notify us so that we escort them to the venue where they are going to present their griefs. Because the other people who have bad intention and evil intention will intrude. Okay, they will get a chance to implement their secret agenda. So we said in the law, the South Sudan Penal Court and Court of Procedure, as well as the Act, the law of evidence, it gives rights, the Bill of Rights, for every citizen to voice whatever he wants to say or to march. But it must be peaceful. And you have to put the law enforcement forces alert, okay? So that for your own benefit, when you are going to present your petition, you reach to the scene of the venue peacefully. Because along the road, the intruders will come in. Those who don't like peace.
Yes.
All right. And then the intruders will come in, they will start burning cars, they will start disturbing the tranquility of the innocent citizen.
Explain to me why there is today, heavy deployment
actually,
on the road.
So the force was deployed, okay, just to be on alert, a show of force, to be on alert, to be alert to the citizens that there is no problem. We are ready to protect them.
You're ready to protect them from
what?
What
has really happened?
You say you are showing force to ensure the citizens that you're ready to protect them.
To frighten them. Not showing the force to frighten them or to cause uproar, but to tell them that we are ready to protect them, their life and their property. Showing force as an aggressive force or not showing force that if in case they go to the rampage, we will shoot them because we accept them to present whatever griefs they do, but to keep us informed. Let them write to us that we have a petition to post against the economic crisis of the day. Then we say, okay, where is going your starting point? And where do you want your petition to be presented? To whom are you going to present your petition? Then we will endorse it. Then we'll escort them to the area there where they are going to present the petition. But if they do it secretly, the illegal intended group will have their own agenda. And we will not be also, it will be not peaceful demonstration, it will be unpeaceful.
And who are this group that are organizing people to go on the streets to demonstrate against the economic crisis in the country? Do you know the name of the group?
We have no data or map to particular group, okay? We have sent our intelligence forces on the ground. Being the national security, being the CID, being the police, being the community who are participating to us. to help us in mapping and to identify these illegal, ill-intended people. But at the moment, we have no particular group or civil society that has come up. But we are giving what we call early warning precautions for whatever may happen, according to our intelligence gathering information.
I am getting information from Juba that the police has imposed curfew, no movement at night of civilians. Is that correct?
If the curfew is imposed legally, according to our constitution, it has to go to the parliament. And the parliament, the parliamentarians, the three arms of the government, being the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, will announce to the public that we have a curfew which will start from the morning up to the following morning. And then they will alert us in English language, in Arabic language, in all over the radio. But according to my knowledge, I have not heard of a curfew that can be done secretly, because it has to be done publicly. It has to be put in the newspaper. It has to be put in the radio. It has to be translated in the language that everybody knows.
I've come across a picture on the social media of your officer who is reported to have collapsed because he has not eaten for 4 days. What do you know about that situation?
I've never came across it, but I will check and I'll let you know and I will update you.
That's South Sudan's Deputy Police Spokesperson, Brigadier General James Carlos Dak. He spoke to me from Juba earlier today. South Sudan government is marking Martyrs' Day, observed every July 30th in the country. This day commemorates the death of John Garang Dimabior, who was a Sudanese politician and a revolutionary leader during the Second Sudanese Civil War. Following the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement on January 9, 2005, he briefly served as first vice president of Sudan for only 3 weeks until his death in a helicopter crash on July 30, 2005. The date of his death became marked as Martyrs' Day in South Sudan. Majak Dagot is South Sudan's former Deputy Minister of Defense. He tells me that this day is very important to him.
This has been a long arduous journey. It is a mixed bag of happy moments and also sad moments, given the fact that this was a brutal war that has claimed lives, that has maimed people, that has caused huge devastation in the country in terms of dislocating the lives and prospects of progress.
I've known you for some time. You know, after the CPA, you held a very high position in Sudan, you know, and you were based in Khartoum. After the country became independent, you also held a very high position in the military, the South Sudan military. You were the Deputy Minister of Defense. The country is going through a lot, and you sacrifice your early age to ensure that this country becomes independent. If you reflect back, would you say it was worth a struggle for?
It is worth struggling for. It is an effort well expended by our generation. We do not have any decision regrets at all. We have fought for a just cause. We have achieved independence of our country, a dream of so many generations before us. And so this alone is a source of inspiration for the future generations. There are hurdles for our collective progress, for our collective prosperity. We have so many difficulties, as you know, but this country is not going to go away. We will turn it over to the next generation. Of course, that's not going to be a simple task to make it work for the prosperity, but it is a big achievement of people of South Sudan.
There is a common saying among the people of South Sudan. Some of them are saying the SPLA of 1983, if they are put together in the same room,
with the SPLA of today, there will be fire in that room, because some people think the SPLA moved away from the creed that late Dr. John Garang has been working hard to instill in the minds of those who took up arms to, if you like, liberate the people of South Sudan. What is your comments?
They are entirely right in that kind of assessment. We have degenerated a great deal. There has been a big dent in our value system. Some of the core values that led us to the bush right here in Juba and in Merkel and in Wau and in Khartoum those days, you know, the kind of southern nationalism that galvanized us to take to the bush and take upon ourselves that kind of a weightier task to be able to confront a ruthless enemy like the Khartoum regime, and to be able to snatch our country from the jaws of such an enemy, it was not simple. Unless you were imbued with values that would impel you to sacrifice. Today, those values have, majority of it have withered away. And this is the biggest loss, of course, that this generation has caused to the nation. Otherwise, I still believe that this country has a huge dormant potential. It is possible to awaken its energies and relaunch it into the future as a unified country, as a country that has a purpose.
The last question I would like to put across here is about the real situation on the ground. 6 years have passed the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan. The signatories have been struggling to implement it for 6 years. Even recently, they, you know, reached out to holdout groups, and they've been in Nairobi for, if I'm not mistaken, 3 months negotiating with the government delegation on how they can find a, you know, durable solution for peace in South Sudan. I mean, you have been in the forefront, you have seen it all, whether in the battlegrounds or in the political arena, you have seen it all, or even as a private citizen, you are now, you have seen it all. What is your assessment on the efforts to silence the guns and move beyond this bickering between political parties or signatories, or if you like, rebel groups?
My position always is that these settlements of this nature are ceasefire agreements, and they are not the goal in themselves. They are not the end state. The end state should be transitioning the country to a democratic process. That has not been achieved in the 2015 agreement, because there was a deception in 2016 when the shootout occurred in the palace here in Chuba in 2016. And then getting it back on track took like 2 years. And in Addis Ababa, there was really nothing much that was being added. Our position was that we have to get it back on track and move and transition the country out of conflict to a democratic elections. Then something occurred which was quite unusual. The whole process was shifted to Khartoum, and the first thing that was prioritized by Khartoum was oil and their role in it, including bringing troops to South Sudan to be part of security of oil. So from that point on, a lot of things that were not part of 2015 agreement were introduced. And to me, this had become part of the major hurdle. Say, for example, the idea of necessary unified forces, 80,000. If 80,000 is the necessary, which is the minimum, necessary unified forces, then what is your ceiling? Will your ceiling be 500,000, a million, or a whole country being militarized? So these are some of the difficult things that really making this agreement to a certain degree unimplementable. Having said that, I think the goal should still be to transition the country out of the present trap of perpetual extensions and no elections to something new. And to me, if the ongoing process in Nairobi is going to succeed, it has to be simple. It has actually to focus on core tasks that can be accomplished within the next 1 year or two, and you have the general elections.
That's Majak Dagot, South Sudan's former Deputy Minister of Defense. He spoke to me from the capital, Juba, earlier today. Still on security matters, some residents in Yei, Morobo, and Kajokeji counties in central Equatorial State say they are living in fear after several attacks in villages by armed gunmen in the past weeks. Commissioners and state security advisors blame the rebels of the National Salvation Front, or NAS, for the insecurity. NAS did not pick several calls for comments on this story. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Insecurity in parts of central Equatoria has affected businesses across parts of the state. A man from Udu village in Kajukeji County, who did not want to be named for fear of reprisal from the armed men, says he escaped at night.
On Friday evening, I closed my shop earlier and went home. Then a certain woman in Wudu was asked by two armed men whether she knows my home and that of Simon. She replied that she is still new in the area and has just spent a few months in Wudu. They then questioned her how comes she doesn't know the two people, yet they are famous. In the morning, I was briefed on the security situation. Then I decided to run to the camp until I escaped to Juba.
Panuel Dumo, the commissioner of Kajukeji County, says he is aware of armed men causing mayhem there, adding that his office is working to apprehend them.
A group of people ranging from 6 to 8, dressing with black clothes like a mafia group, when an attack certain men in Jalimo area. So they almost killed this person with the axe panga, but it's good enough this guy survived. Then the same group came and looted Kangapo, a small trading center. They harassed the people there and took their belongings, shoes, sandals, including the beer.
Dumo says he is meeting with chiefs and other local leaders to enforce a 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew to curb insecurity in the county.
At 9, the patrol will continue up to 6 a.m. in the morning. This has been imposed and is going to continue until we normalize the situation. All the executive chiefs, the chiefs, church leaders, the landlords, business community, youth and women, we are going to have a serious meeting. And from that meeting, I think we will be working out modalities.
Luwate Justin, the chairperson of the Yei Chamber of Commerce, says traders are living in fear after one businesswoman was allegedly killed on her way to the Democratic Republic of Congo. He says the government should beef up security and provide assistance to traders whose goods were burned down in a market in Yei last week.
Most of them are widows who lost their husbands during the conflict. There was a woman who was transporting fish from Yei to Congo and she got ambushed on the way and was killed. So these are the situations that indicate Yei has a lot of security issues. And up to now, as we talk, there were two people who were abducted on the same day and their whereabouts are not known up to now. So that means situations are not good at all.
Similar incidents happened in Morobo County after an ambulance was allegedly burned by armed men affiliated to the National Salvation Front, NAS. Mawa Joseph, the commissioner of Morobo County, says four people, including a midwife and a driver, are believed to be in the custody of National Salvation Front rebels.
The first instance, they were arrested. Three. The following day, also one was arrested. But the other one, the last who was been abducted, he managed to escape yesterday. Currently, I'm waiting for him to come to my office to explain where I've been taken, in which location, so that he can able to explain to me.
Angelo Daya is the Central Equatorial State Security Advisor. He says the government is setting up a security team to assess the situation in counties affected by insecurity across the state.
Currently, Central Equatoria Leadership has actually directed my office to be coordinating throughout to know out what exactly is happening and what support to be given to a commissioner, make sure that calm totally has to come to Kajukeji. That is all about Kajukeji. And then around Yei town, also there are our brothers who are still whole art group, NAS, are adopting some youth, taking them out. As I speak, even yesterday, they took some, four of them, leaving the vehicle along the road.
Suba Samuel, spokesperson of the National Salvation Front, did not answer several calls and text messages seeking comment for this story. In June, a breakaway faction of NAS, calling itself the Joint Command Council, JCC, led by General Kenny Lobron, warned the commuters to cease movement between Juba and Yei. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonye reporting from Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, women and media in Africa. Find out why women are portrayed negatively in some media houses across the continent. That's... You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A 2023 study found women were underrepresented and marginalized in the Liberian media industry. A female journalists association set up a pilot program to bring about change. From Monrovia, Sinau Todd has more.
At Prime FM in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, Christophina Pinky Nyene prepares to read the major news bulletin of the day. It is a career leap for the journalist. Until about 2 months ago, she worked mainly behind the scenes. Nyene is one of a handful of new female journalists to join Prime FM. With her colleagues focused on politics, Nyene's coverage of the environment and human rights was often overshadowed. And she says the help she received transitioning into a radio career was limited.
My confidence level was not high. I did not know how to write or lead or real good lead. Sometimes when I read my stories, my editor would be like, what is this, Christophina? What is this?
But all changed when Prime FM joined the pilot gender ethics program. Nyana is now an anchor and has a mentor. The gender ethics policy is a response to a 2023 report by the Electoral Institute for Sustainable Democracy in Africa. The report found significant underrepresentation and marginalization of women in newsrooms and frequent objectification or degradation of them in news stories. That imbalance, says the Female Journalist Association of Liberia, or FIJAL, reduces women's representation in government, which in turn affects policy. The hostile climate came to the fore in the 2023 elections when the media focused on a candidate's old beauty pageant pictures instead of her policies. Lisa Tene Diase is the president of FIJAL.
Everything about Woki Dolo was about her bikini. I think bikini or something, because she took part in the Miss Liberia and she was a former Miss Liberia. Everything about her life that had transitioned from the pageantry to political, everything came back on pageantry.
Seeing a need for a change, FIJAL formed and piloted a policy in 30 media institutions, the SSAs.
So that particular policy would take into account how many growth of women in the newsroom, growth of reporting women or gender stories, and making sure women can also take on the airwaves to talk about their issues and also report issues as well.
FIJAL offers internships, career mentorships, and the Newsroom Leaders Fellowship. It's already seeing results, says Lamakoli, desk editor for Women's TV, Liberia.
I improve my leadership ability, improve my writing skills, my capacity to nurture and manage the newsroom and improve. And because of that, I was upgraded to become editor of my newsroom.
The pilot is also bringing other changes too. Prime Communications Network now has a dedicated gender desk to produce content that highlights Liberian women, says network director Jutonu Uwatekoli.
So if you bring a story, I want to see the gender length. I want to see the female side of that story.
After its promising start, Fija hopes that more media outlets will adopt the policy and that newsrooms and audiences will see a more balanced representation of women. Sena Nutod, VOA News, Monrovia.
From women issues in Liberia, we go to Europe for crime issues. For months, European governments and the U.S. have accused Russia of carrying out sabotage attacks on military and civilian infrastructure across the continent. London police in April say they charged two British men with aiding Russian intelligence following a suspected arson attack on a business with ties to Ukraine. As Henry Wilkins reports from London, the incidents have shaken Ukrainians who feel targeted in places where they have sought refuge.
An industrial park on the outskirts of London may seem like an unlikely scene for a Russian attack on Ukraine. But in March, say British police, that's what happened. They charged two British men with collaborating with Russian intelligence after a warehouse was allegedly set on fire, destroying it. The facility was owned by a company transporting aid to Ukraine. There has been no plea in the case and no Russian comment. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has warned of an uptick in sabotage attacks by Russia across Europe.
The Kremlin's also been intensifying its hybrid attacks against frontline states, NATO members, setting fire and sabotaging supply warehouses, disregarding sea borders and demarcations in the Baltics, mounting more and more cyber attacks, continuing to spread disinformation.
Juliana Yashova fled her home in Ukraine and came to Britain in 2023. Upon visiting the site of the burned warehouse, she said she was shocked to see something like this on British soil.
And when we see that the result of it being burned to the ground, this is really, really painful. And I think to prevent it, to somehow control much better Russian intelligence in Europe, because it has such deep roots here, it has such long hands.
Similar incidents have been reported in Spain, Germany, which this social media footage purports to show, as well as in France, while Latvia's president and officials from the Netherlands and Lithuania have warned more attacks may be possible. Mark Hanna of the Institute for Global Affairs says incidents like these are consistent with Russia's covert efforts to weaken support for Ukraine.
So if it thinks that these acts of arson and these acts of sabotage will somehow weaken the will of publics in these countries, that is, I think, one of the primary motivations for Russia for carrying out these acts.
German prosecutors have accused Russia of trying to weaken military support for Ukraine. As European governments look for answers, reports of the attacks are causing anguish among Ukrainian refugees who thought they had come to a safe space. At a Ukrainian social club in London, Ukrainian refugee Lyudmila Kazmiruk says the attacks are hitting in the most unexpected places. She says Ukrainian children in Britain are encountering Kremlin propaganda online. She feels traumatised.
I started to hate Russian language. When I hear Russian language, I just, something inside me, I'm just afraid of that person.
Russia calls the accusations of sabotage yet another unfounded accusation on the part of the West. For Ukrainians who thought they were fleeing to safety in Britain and elsewhere in Europe, the trauma caused by the often unexplained incidents is very real. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, London.
That's all we had on our menu for this Tuesday, July 30th, 2024. We now go to Western Equatoria State with Tutu and the song Sogote, which means hatred. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Cornelius, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mama, sakata chile, kumamu mamburo, baby, liko. Mama, sakata chile, kumamu mamburo, ya. Mama, sakata chile, kumamu mamburo, beba nambara.